This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Soon after Entergy Corporation made the surprise declaration that it was planning to shut down Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Plant, questions emerged about just what that would entail. On the morning of the announcement, Entergy's chief nuclear officer, Jeff Forbes, outlined the company's intentions for decommissioning.
The company will establish a decommissioning planning organization who will be responsible for planning and executing the safe and efficient decommissioning of the facility. Full decommissioning is a long process and could take decades. Once the plant is shut down, workers will defuel the reactor and place the plant in safe store, which is an NRC-approved process in which the facility is maintained and monitored in a safe condition, and the decontamination and dismantling of the site occurs later.
All right, there's a lot going on there. So today on the program, we're going to take a look at the process for decommissioning a nuclear plant like Vermont Yankee, how much time it takes, what safe store entails, and what's actually involved in dismantling a reactor. We're going to be focusing on the technical aspects of this process. So if you want to talk politics, head over to the Vermont Edition Facebook page and have at it, respectfully. We will put a little post up there. You can share your thoughts on Vermont Yankee on the political side. But if you're scratching your head about the engineering that's involved in decommissioning and who decides how a plant gets decommissioned, give us a call now at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your questions at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. I'm joined now by Bruce Watson, branch chief in charge of reactor decommissioning at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Bruce, it's nice to have you on the program. Thanks for coming.
I'm glad to be here.
All right, let's start right in. So there are boiling water reactors and pressurized water reactors when we start talking about nuclear power plants. Vermont Yankee is a boiling water reactor, a BWR. Can you explain the components and methods of the plant's operation in as plain English as you possibly can?
Yes. The principal difference between a pressurized water reactor and a boiling water reactor is that in a boiling water reactor, the actual steam that is made to turn the turbines and generate the electricity goes directly from the reactor into the turbine system, and then that makes the electricity. So if you think of a teapot and it's boiling water, that steam would go directly to the turbine to turn the electrical generator to make the electricity. In a pressurized water, there's a separated loop there between the turbine and the reactor system. So it's a very simple system. It does require a lot of maintaining a very good chemistry and good water quality when they put the water into the reactor, so it is, you know, made into the steam.
And actually, we have a diagram of what Bruce Watson is talking about up on our webpage. It's at vpr.net. Click on today's Vermont Edition if you need a visual description of what Bruce is describing, because it can be hard even just to picture what we're talking about. So, Bruce, which parts of the plant of Vermont Yankee are radiological and which aren't?
Well, obviously the reactor system is contaminated or radioactive. The turbine itself is contaminated or radioactive component, since the radioactive steam comes out and goes through the condenser. That is also a radioactive component, and then the piping that returns it, along with all the systems that are used to make the plant run efficiently. There's a number of different heat exchangers which improve the steam quality. And then there's also the systems that support that cleanup of that water so that they maintain good quality water when they put it back in the reactor. The non-contaminated parts of the plant are actually most of the structures, some of the support systems. The actual generator that produces the electricity is non-contaminated. So in many respects, there's quite a bit of non-contaminated material that, you know, comprise the whole reactor site.
And when it comes to decommissioning or dismantling the plant, can that non-radioactive stuff that you're talking about, you know, some of the offices, some of the other structures, can they just be dismantled and sold or discarded or whatever?
Yes, and in one model in decommissioning, some of the plants will take some of the non-radioactive components, the stuff that's never been impacted by the reactor or the contamination or whatever, and they will recycle some of those materials, some of the structural steel from some of the buildings. One plant in particular has a plan to recycle most of the concrete from the facility, and that plant is Trojan out in Oregon, and that has been their plan all along, to recycle as much material out of the plant as they could.
But that's something the NRC regulates as well, even though that portion of the plant is non-radioactive, non-radiological?
We would make sure that the measurement program in which those materials were released were not contaminated, and make sure the validation of that. And that would be done during the decommissioning process. Now, once we do terminate the reactor license, the operating license, and actually shrink the we shrink the site down to just the spent fuel facility, then that would be all that material would become unrestricted for whatever purpose the utility or licensee wanted to do.
Okay. So, Bruce, take us ahead a year to around this time, maybe a month or two later, next fall, as Vermont Yankee gets to the end of its current fuel cycle. Just walk us through those very first steps. It shuts down, it goes offline, and it defuels.
Right. The first step in the decommissioning process, and these are outlined in our federal regulations, 10 CFR 50.82. There's a section on decommissioning license termination for regulations. The first part is that the licensee notifies us within 30 days that they are permanently ceasing operations. So that tells us their intent and when they're going to do that.
Do they have to tell you that within 30 days before or just within 30 days of the shutdown?
Within 30 days of.
So after the shutdown is fine.
Can be, yeah.
Okay.
And then secondly, they would defuel the reactor, and that may take a number of weeks to do. And at that point, once the reactor is completely defueled, they would also send us another certification that they have permanently removed the fuel from the reactor. And that takes place whenever that occurs. The last thing that does in this first initial step here is they are required within 2 years to give us what's called the post-shutdown decommissioning activities report. Now, it's a mouthful, but we generally call it the PSDAR. But the post-shutdown decommissioning activities report is required to be submitted to us within 2 years after they've ceased operations. And the purpose of the PSDAR, as we call it, is basically a description and schedule for the planned decommissioning activities. In other words, what strategy they're going to use and their schedules. They also have to provide us an updated estimate of the expected decommissioning costs. Now, keep in mind, those costs are to radiologically clean up the plant. It is not necessarily to totally greenfield the plant, as we would call it, totally remove all the structures. It's just to a point where they could submit their reports that we would review, and hopefully we will all the plant would be released for unrestricted use. So that cost estimate is solely for the radioactive part of the plant, which is what we regulate. And then the third part of that is a discussion is required to be in there on the environmental impacts associated with the decommissioning activities, and that they are they were bounded or are going to be within, hopefully, the already issued environmental impact statement that was issued for the plant to operate.
So let me ask you this, just to break it down. You mentioned that before they give you that post-shutdown decommissioning activities report, the PSDAR, they have to tell you they're shutting down the plant. Now, they've told us they're going to shut down the plant, but just so that we're clear, according to the NRC, I mean, there has been no regulatory paperwork filed. This is just something that they've told us, not initiated some actual technical plan with the NRC.
Correct. This is just a press release, I would call it. We require a certification from the licensee, from probably their chief nuclear officer, that the plant is shutting down permanently, and also that certification that when the fuel's removed.
So you don't expect to get that until right around when the plant is shutting down.
Right. So if it's the end of 2014, I think one of the press releases is, that's when we'll probably get it, sometime in that time frame.
And can you explain, you know, if we're waiting here for the end of the fuel cycle, why doesn't that mean that the plant is out of fuel? Because when it defuels, it's taking some of that fuel out. So why doesn't the end of a fuel cycle mean the plant is completely out of fuel?
Well, the nuclear fuel becomes high-level waste and is still highly radioactive when they shut the plant down and either defuel or refuel it. And so that waste has to be handled. And so in the fuel cycle, basically the amount of uranium-235 as used to operate the plant decreases slowly over that time that the plant operates. And so there is the fuel is actually, you know, radioactive, but still most of the uranium-235 has been used up at the end of the fuel cycle.
And usually when a plant refuels, it's actually taking about a third of its fuel rods out and replacing them. So there is still fuel that can be generated within that. Okay.
Yes, that's correct. In a typical refueling, they would replace about one third of the fuel elements.
So where is that nuclear fuel going to go immediately when the plant shuts down?
The fuel will be transferred to the spent fuel pool. It's a large, basically, pool. It's, I want to say, probably 20, 30 feet of water above the fuel when it's put in the storage racks. That water provides cooling for the fuel, and it also provides shielding so that there's very low dose rates for the workers.
And the fuel rods stay in that pool for, what, about 5 to 7 years until they are cooled down and can go into dry cask storage?
In a typical situation, before the fuel is cool enough, meaning energy-wise, thermal-wise, to be put into the dry storage casks, it takes typically 5 to 7 years for that fuel to cool down, as we would say, before it's eligible to be put into the dry storage containers.
And does Entergy have to tell you in its plan when it plans to move that spent fuel into dry cask storage, or is that something that just automatically happens as soon as that fuel is cool enough?
Well, I think that's part of the strategy they will provide to us. As a matter of fact, they can leave the fuel in the spent fuel pool for the duration of the safe store if they choose to.
And in fact, one nuclear plant has done that, right? They have kept their spent fuel in those pools for 30 years or so. Or...
Yeah, there's a couple of them that have done that. The one in Connecticut still has their fuel in the Unit 1 pool. That's been in safe store for, 15 years at this point. There's another one in Illinois. Actually, two units, and they're actually in active decon right now, meaning they are actively dismantling the plant, which had their fuel in storage for about 15 years, and now they're making plans to move to dry storage.
We're talking today with Bruce Watson. He's branch chief in charge of reactor decommissioning at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and we're learning what decommissioning a nuclear plant actually entails, so we have a better idea of what might happen at Vermont Yankee. Bruce has mentioned safe store and decon. Decon, the decommissioning process. Safe store, when you basically mothball the plant for a number of decades, make sure that it's safe and leave it there, often so that the fund can continue to grow to decommission the plant. We're going to talk more about both of those options and how they're sometimes used in conjunction when we come back for our break. You can call with your science questions about decommissioning, 1-800-639-2211, or post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking with Bruce Watson, branch chief in charge of reactor decommissioning at the NRC, about how a plant like Vermont Yankee is shut down and decommissioned. We're finding out about what safe store entails, basically putting the plant into hibernation for up to 50 years or so, and then finishing decommissioning. And we're getting all of our technical questions answered about how the process actually works. If you have questions about all of this, you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. So, Bruce Watson, let's talk a little bit about decommissioning. Can you tick down basically what that entails?
Okay. I mentioned that the post-shutdown decommissioning activities report is required to be submitted in 2 years. And that basically outlines the strategy, whether the plant's going to go into decommissioning, into decon, or to safe store. And during that first 2 years is when they prepare the plant for decommissioning. And in that stage, they remove the low-level waste that's in the facility, drain systems, electrically disconnect systems that are not needed anymore, basically prepare the plant so that once the plant is ready, at that point, for decommissioning, it can either stay in safe store or go to dismantling. And at that point, if they're going to go to safe store, the plant is basically maintained in, hate to use the word mothballed, but in a safe storage condition, which we will continue to inspect throughout its lifetime and make sure it's in safe condition and that the plant is maintained safe and secure. If they go into decommissioning for decon, where they're doing active dismantling, then they will have a plan which outlines the schedule and the components and how they're going to do various removal of the facility. And by that, it takes typically seven to 10 years to actually do the dismantling of the plant and ship the radioactive waste off-site.
And when you say radioactive waste, you're not talking about the spent fuel rods.
No,
those stay on-site.
Yeah, I'm talking about the low-level waste. And I guess in Vermont's case, they're part of the compact with Texas, so they have access to the WCS, which I think is the Waste Control Specialist facility in Texas, for the disposal of the waste.
So like what waste?
Well, actually, the many of the plants start with actually working inside the reactor vessel. That work is highly radioactive because it's been near the fuel, and that work is done by a specialty contractor, typically that segments and cuts up the reactor internals, the things that held the fuel together, held the fuel in the reactor. They will segment that, cut it up into smaller pieces so it can be packaged underwater because it's highly radioactive, and then packaged in a shielded container where it can be transported to the burial site.
And these are not divers doing that work, right?
No, they're
robots because it's highly radioactive.
Right, and this really requires a very specialized contractor to do this type of work. There's not many of them in the world, but there are contractors who specialize in this kind of work.
Okay.
And that takes maybe a year or two to complete that kind of work. After the highly radioactive material is removed from the vessel, they may remove some of the larger components associated with the reactor itself. In many cases, such as at Main Yankee, which has been completely decommissioned, they removed the reactor vessel as one single component, and it was shipped by barge to the burial site. At that time, it was in South Carolina. I think Yankee Row did the same thing, which has been completely decommissioned. And I think their reactor vessel, if I recall, went by rail car down to the same facility in South Carolina to be disposed of.
Boy, you must have to have some pretty high security while you're doing that.
Security, and the important thing is the infrastructure for being able to move these types of large components. You have to have, you know, bridges that can handle the weight and access to the rail or access to a barge to get this material, you know, safely loaded and shipped. The other part of this is that if those aren't available, a lot of utilities are presently looking at cutting up the reactor vessel itself and cutting it up into small pieces where it can fit into a shielded container to be shipped also to a burial site.
Okay, so that's decommissioning. You're basically, once the plant is in a safe conditioning, you're taking out these radioactive pieces. The reactor internals are shipped to Texas in our case. You're removing some of the other radiological stuff that's on the site, decontaminating the structure of the plant. And as you said, Bruce, that can take 7 to 10 years.
Right.
You mentioned the company also has the option of putting the plant into safe store, basically just
right.
sort of pauses everything once it's in a safe place.
Right.
And I want to ask you about that, but also there is a possibility, depending on what the company wants to do, that they can go in and out of safe store. So they can sort of do nothing for a little while and then work on some of the decommissioning, then put it back into safe store. Do they have to tell you about that in their document, the PSDAR, when they give it to you?
They generally set out, like I said, their schedule and their how they're going to conduct the decommissioning. In our regulations, they have 60 years to complete the decommissioning. And that's based on the fact that after about 50 years, the radioactive components are now about 1% of the radiation levels they were when the plant was shut down. So that saves a lot of exposure for the workers. It also reduces the amount of radioactive waste to about 10% of what it was because of radioactive decay. In that 50-year period, then they have 10 years to decommission the plant, do the active decommissioning, and they're required to complete that decommissioning, like I said, in 60 years, which would be the 50 plus 10. Now, most plants have not gone that route, but some have those in their plans because they're at multi-unit facilities where they want to make sure that the safe operation of the other of the operating facilities is not impacted by the decommissioning activities. So, yeah, it's their option. One good example, which you just mentioned, was La Crosse, which is out in Wisconsin, has been in safe store and then became very active in removing their vessel. They moved their reactor vessel. They placed their fuel in dry storage. And now they're kind of in a slow dismantling. They're still in decon now, but they're at a slower rate. And part of that is to allow their decommissioning fund, I believe, to grow and continue to contain the costs. I was going to mention another plant, which is Fermi, recently completed most of the decommissioning but went back into safe store in order to allow that decommissioning fund to grow.
So in Vermont's case, Governor Shumlin has said he would prefer if the company didn't put the plant into safe store. He wants to get that site back into a usable, functional site as quickly as possible. But the state doesn't have any control over the company's plan in terms of whether it's doing safe store or decon. And the NRC doesn't have control. You just have to approve the company's plan. Is that correct?
That's pretty much it. We make sure that whatever they do, is the plant remains safe and secure. And like I said, we do inspect the plant throughout its life. And if there's a lot of significant major decommissioning activities there, then we are there inspecting more frequently. If they're in safe store, we're there generally at least annually.
But Governor Shumlin can't say to you, we want you to say no to safe store.
No, that's not what we can do. That's not in our regulations. I was going to say, though, that in many cases, these sites are very valuable to the utility. If you think about it, they generally have cooling water. The site has already had an environmental impact statement done. It has the infrastructure with the grid distribution system because it generated power into the state. And so these types of sites are generally fairly valuable to the utility. At Humboldt Bay, for example, out in California, they have put in 8 combustion turbines units to supplement their grid system in Northern California. Out at La Crosse, they've built a fossil plant next to the reactor that they're decommissioning because they have the grid infrastructure in the Mississippi River there to provide the cooling water. So in many cases, the actual site is very valuable to the utility in maintaining their generation capacity to the customer. Whereas other sites, such as Maine Yankee and Yankee Row and Connecticut Yankee, have been completely decommissioned and they're greenfielded.
Bruce, let's go to Kirk, who's on the line and has a question for you from Burlington. Hi, Kirk. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you guys today? Thank you for taking my call. Great show. I've got two questions. They're both relative to financing, the cleanup. 2006, the fund was woefully short, and there was a projection that they were looking at a 7% annual rate of return to beef up the decommissioning fund. One, where exactly is the money coming from? And number two, moving forward, what assurances do we have as Vermonters that I'm not going to get stuck with a bill on somebody else's dime?
Kirk, thanks for your questions. Bruce Watson?
excuse me. Our regulations require that they report to us using a formula, which is the minimum amount of finances that or funding that they need to decommission the plant. That's reported to us, I think, on a I think every five-year basis, and then it is required to be reported to us on an annual basis once they enter decommissioning. Now, as far as the whether the fund is adequate at this point, we will find that out when they submit the post-shutdown decommissioning activities report, because they are to address the amount of funding that is required to complete the decommissioning from a radiological standpoint.
But you don't know how much is in the fund now. They don't have to tell you.
No, it's an operating plant right now, and I don't really have that information.
So what happens if they're dipping into and out of that fund, going in and out of SafeStore to do some of the decommissioning? How do you keep an eye on whether or not, you know, in 50 years when they need to make sure that they're, you know, really decommissioning and finishing within 60 years, that there is enough money to do that?
Well, that's why every year they're required to report to us the amount of funding that is available, or amount of funding that is required also to complete the decommissioning. So they report that to us annually, and that's also in our regulations. And from that, you know, they're basically saying they have enough money to do the job.
What if the company goes bankrupt?
Well, that's something that I think there's a requirement in our regulations that says it's basically that the licensee is responsible for the safe operation and licensing of the plant until it's released from the license, and that's a requirement in the law.
So bankruptcy doesn't affect that requirement?
I'm not really a legal expert to answer that question, but there is what's called the common defense clause, which someone would be responsible for that from the company since they were issued a license for it.
All right. That looks like an area to follow up on. Bruce Watson, we got another question for you before we let you go from Matt in Putney, who wants you to describe what a fully decommissioned site looks like. So what might we be able to picture in up to 60 years?
Okay. There's a couple ways to look at it. They can choose what is done at Trojan and at Rancho Seco out in California. Trojan's in Oregon. Basically, they decontaminated the plant completely. They removed all the radioactive components, and we conducted surveys of all the structures that were left behind and basically certified and confirmed what their findings were that they met the requirements for license termination. So in that case, the entire containment building is still standing, all the system buildings, the auxiliary building, the spent fuel facility or wet storage was still there, even though it's been all decontaminated and released. And the license was shrunk down to the spent fuel facility, the dry storage. The other option, I guess when you want to call it as an end state, is to go to Greenfield. And in that case, like Maine Yankee, they removed all the structures. Removed all the visible structures. I believe they were allowed to leave some of the foundations in, which were non-contaminated, down to about 8 feet, 6-8 feet, and then they covered it with soil. And in this case, they regrew native grasses and stuff over the area, and that's why we call it Greenfield.
And will that be in the Entergy plan, or is that something that happens, the Greenfield?
Well, like I said, they're not required to take the plant to Greenfield by our regulations. They are required to clean up the plant and meet our radiological release criteria. And that means that even if the building's still standing, it is radiologically clean. It's up to the utility to do whatever they want to do with that facility when they choose to do that.
Quickly, the spent fuel that's going into dry cask storage and remaining on site, basically that stays on site regardless of what happens until and unless the federal government comes up with another plan for storing spent fuel?
Yes, that's true. And it's up to the federal government to resolve the high-level waste disposal issue. That facility will be licensed by the NRC. It will continue to be inspected and ensured that the facility is secure and has the appropriate security to maintain that facility in a safe condition.
Bruce Watson is the branch chief in charge of reactor decommissioning at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Bruce, thank you very much for helping explain the process of how decommissioning works.
Well, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
And listeners, if you missed any of that, there will be a podcast up. You can always listen to the rebroadcast tonight, and you can always find all of our recordings at vpr.net. Coming up, how a chance mandolin purchase on eBay led our next guest to discover that he had connections to the man who made the instrument almost 100 years ago. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Imagine buying a mandolin on eBay, doing a little research, and finding the story of a luthier, one who makes stringed musical instruments, whose life paralleled your own. That's what happened to our next guest. Joel Eckhouse, a luthier and musician who lives in Portland, Maine, wrote a story for Fretboard Journal about how his research has uncovered many uncanny similarities he has with that mandolin's maker, John Henry Parker. Joel Eckhouse joins us now. Joel, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hello, Jane. Nice to be here.
If you're an instrument maker yourself, why did you want to buy this particular mandolin on eBay in the first place?
Well, someone pointed out to me that it was made in Portland, Maine, and that intrigued me. And I was also really intrigued by the shape of the instrument, which was definitely different from most mandolins that I've seen.
So what then got you interested in the instrument's maker, John Henry Parker?
When I got the instrument in the mail, I looked in the label, and it said on the inside, the Bandola Company, Portland, Maine. And I thought, well, I wonder where this guy lived and where he worked. This is my town. So I went to the local historical society and did some research there. And that's when I found out that he lived about less than a mile from me, and he worked right next door to where I used to work.
So you found out that he had that connection to you in Portland, and you've actually, well, now probably many times, but you walked by, you went to the places where he had lived and worked to have a look at them.
Yeah, sure.
And then you traced him back even deeper, and it weirdly went deeper into your backstory, too. Tell us about that.
Well, I found also online that he had lived in Burlington, Vermont, of all places, and that also was a place that I had lived. And I moved to Burlington around 1972. I had no idea at the time that I was going to be a luthier, or that I didn't even know what a luthier really was. But at one point I made the decision that maybe building instruments was going to be something I wanted to do. And I moved to town, and it turns out I moved to Willard Street, about a block from where John Henry used to live.
Did that feel weird when you found that out, when you thought, boy, he's right near where I am in Portland, Maine, and then you realize that you basically crossed paths, although in different times,
yeah,
in Vermont?
Well, it was starting to get my attention, and I wasn't really, you know, ready to make any more leaps of faith beyond that, you know, that it was an interesting coincidence, but then more stuff started to come up.
Like what?
Well, I found out that some of my instruments resembled his instruments, that I use a certain style of purfling on my instruments. There's a red and white line in my purfling.
And explain purfling. This is like a border?
Around the edge of a guitar or a mandolin, you'll see a binding which kind of protects the edge, and inside that you'll see a couple of black and white lines, or maybe a few more, and often that's kind of the signature of the luthier. Each luthier has a different number of lines that he might put in, and mine was almost identical to John Henry's.
What years are we talking about? Just frame us in the context.
Well, the instrument that I bought, it was 1907. And I started building instruments around 1974. So, you know, a good 60-plus years apart, 70 years apart.
So when John Henry Parker was making these instruments, did they look super modern? If you're making instruments that look a little bit antique now, were his designs super modern at the time?
Well, his designs were definitely unique, and he marketed them that way. He was very interested in promoting the fact that they looked different, that they sounded different, that they played different, and he was also a performer, as was many of his family members, so they were out performing on the instruments and demonstrating them.
And you're a performer as well. Do you see any similarities in your story in terms of performing with his?
Well, there's many there, too. That's another scary part, is that I, too, was performing. I was living in Vermont. I was performing in old vaudeville halls around the state, playing playing string music on violins and banjos and mandolins and guitars, exactly the same instruments that his family band used. And then he was also, in the early days, he was in a banjo quartet out of Boston called the Imperial Banjo Quartet. And as it turned out later on in my life, I joined a New York banjo ensemble that played kind of similar material. And again, a banjo quartet in both lives.
I'm talking with Joel Eckhaus, a luthier and musician in Portland, Maine, who wrote an essay for Fretboard Journal about his connection to John Henry Parker, who made instruments in Burlington, Vermont for a time. And we have a link to that article on our webpage at vpr.net. Joel, as the picture of John Henry Parker's life emerged through your research, did you get some sense, some weird sense of the connection between the two of you? I don't want to say, you know, you're John Henry Parker reincarnated, but there must be some weird feeling to have this chance encounter with a mandolin and then learn all of these connections.
Well, that's kind of what led me to write the article, was that after half a dozen or more of these kind of synchronicities occurred, I thought, well, this is an interesting little story, at least interesting to me anyhow. So I started to write it down. And as I wrote, more and more events or coincidences began to turn up in my mind anyhow. And whether they're some sort of spiritual connection, that's, you know, I'm not at liberty to say.
And you actually got in touch with his family. You now are connected to some of his great-grandchildren, is it?
Yeah, that's one of the blessings of the Internet, is that, you know, I was online talking to a few people about the instrument, and one of the family members clicked in and, you know, found my discussion and contacted me, and that enabled me to find out more about Mr. Parker and his life, his family, his instruments. It was a great connection.
So now what, Joel? I understand you're planning on building an entire family of instruments based on his designs, and then you want to go out and perform with them?
Well, that would be a pipe dream in any case. I've built two copies of his instrument, and they're not perfect copies. They're kind of what I would consider improvements to his design. And but I would like eventually to build an entire quartet of mandolins, which he himself did. And yeah, I'd like to perform with it. That would be great.
Joel, has this become an obsession for you?
yeah, I guess it has. I'm doing way too much self-promotion and just sitting back and watching this thing grow. But it is something that's been on my mind for about the past 6 months.
Well, it sounds like, too, you'd like us all to know a little bit more about John Henry Parker, because you've at least found that he was kind of a remarkable person.
That's my goal, and possibly some of his instruments may come out of the woodwork, and maybe some more information about him and his family, maybe some recordings that, you know, we don't know what is out there still.
Joel Eckhaus is a luthier and musician, now in Portland, Maine. For a time he was, as he said, in Burlington, Vermont. His story in Fretboard Journal explores his connections with instrument maker John Henry Parker, who lived in Burlington and in Keene, New Hampshire, and right near Joel in Portland, Maine. We have a link to that at vpr.net. Joel, thank you so much for telling this story.
It was a great pleasure, and thank you for talking to me.
And that will do it for today's show. Now, tomorrow, this is the time of year when strangers might walk up to you on the street and beg you to take some extra zucchini off their hands. Vermont summers may be short, but they sure are productive. We're going to learn some tips and tricks and recipes for what to do with all of those zucchinis and tomatoes, in my case, cucumbers, and all of the other bounty of the season. Send your comments or questions about harvest largesse to vermontedition@vpr.net. Our show is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Neil Charnoff directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.